So the title of my scripture this, or my sermon this week is, Not All Compromise is Good. And I saw this picture this week as I was going through a car magazine, and it made me think of the subject of compromise. When I saw this picture, I thought of John and Janine Allwine heading out to go shopping for a new vehicle. Knowing John, I think he's probably imagining a nice truck, a big engine, lots of power, room to haul things, maybe sporty wheels. And unfortunately, Janine's probably thinking in her mind, I hope we can find a new Fiat 500. They say that being able to compromise is one of the most important parts of a marriage. But as you can see, sometimes when you take two desires, both of them good in their own way, and mix them together, sometimes the end result isn't that good. One of the quotes I thought that fit this picture very well was, the definition of a compromise is a deal where two people get what neither one wanted. And I think if John and Janine brought this vehicle home, that would definitely be the case. This wouldn't have been what either one of them wanted. The reality is, for about the last 4 weeks, God has been putting the subject of compromise on my mind almost daily. Shortly after the last time I preached, I went back through some of my notes, looking at old Bible studies that I taught, hoping that God would put an idea into my head. And for better or worse, the Bible study that kept finding itself at the top of the pile was a Bible study on compromise. And that really wasn't what I wanted to preach on. But the next day when I was driving to work, there was a sermon on the radio that was about how compromise is the greatest difficulty facing the Christian church today. The next day it got even worse. I turned on the radio, I was listening to a preacher, and he strongly encouraged everyone who was listening to go home that night and read the book of Daniel. So being, you know, maybe this is God leading me, maybe there'll be a sermon in the book of Daniel that I can do instead of compromise. And I went home that night and I read the book of Daniel, and would you know, every single chapter was about Daniel and his friends not compromising on what God wanted. For about the next 3 weeks, it seemed that every Sunday in Dennis's Sunday school class, he would touch on how the Apostle Paul wouldn't apologize in delivering the message of salvation both to his brethren of the Jewish faith and also of the Gentiles. And then finally this week, I went into a Bible study group that we have at work, and all anybody wanted to talk about for the full half hour they was there is how the Christian church is compromising and trying to be like the world. So no matter how much I wanted to get away from speaking on compromise today, I think God made it pretty clear to me that this is what I'm supposed to do. Now, you might be wondering why I would want to avoid the subject of compromise. The reality is, compromise is one of the most divisive subjects in the church today. It's not hard to look on Facebook or Twitter or even listen to a conversation in the back of the church on a Sunday morning and hear people fighting about some subject the church faces. Some of the topics I can laugh about. You know, whether or not it's okay for a preacher to wear jeans and a t-shirt, or if he should wear a suit and tie. I debated on wearing the jeans and a t-shirt today, and then I kind of talked myself out of it, but I definitely didn't think about wearing a suit and tie today. You hear other people arguing about whether it's okay to read things in the King James Version or in the Amplified Version, but after that, things start to get pretty serious. You'll see people who call themselves Christian arguing about whether or not it's okay to vote for that Republican guy who's running for president, and just about as many other people saying whether or not it's okay to vote for that woman who's running as a Democrat. You see people arguing about whether it's okay for women to be pastors in churches, And perhaps most important, you see people in the Church of Christ arguing whether or not people of other faiths, people like Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims, can be saved by the teaching of their religion. And amidst all those arguments, you'll always see some one peaceful person who's going to be like, can't we just all get along? Can't we meet somewhere in the middle so that everyone is happy? The trouble is, when we read our Bibles, we don't always see that as the picture that God paints. Sometimes there isn't a compromise, and we have to choose whether we're going to follow God's teaching or not. Now, I'm going to start out with one of my favorite quotes that I ran into this week on the subject of compromise. You'll be able to tell right away why it's one of my favorites. And the quote was, "A compromise is the art of dividing a cake in such a way that everyone believes that he has the biggest piece." If you have children, you know how hard this is. We've gotten to the point where we count noodles of macaroni and cheese. We've put pieces of cake on a digital scale to ensure them that they are both getting the exact same weight. But you know, in this cake example, everyone leaves feeling good about the compromise they made because they think they won. I fear that we do that sometimes when we try to compromise with God. We come away feeling good about our compromise when maybe we shouldn't. Some great examples where we can look at the subject of compromising with God once appear in the book of Daniel. And as I looked through the book of Daniel this week, I tried to pick stories that I thought fit teaching about compromise, and I ended up with 6 chapters worth of preaching. Now, Dennis came in this morning and said, "How long is this going to take? We have a baptism at 3, you know." And I thought, well, I got to cut something out because it probably was like 2 hours. And I thought, I could either cut what I'm saying or maybe I could cut what God's saying. Does that second one sound like a compromise? So what I'm going to do is maybe cut down on what I'm going to be saying, but I think what God has to say in the book of Daniel is so meaningful and powerful to us that I'm not going to trim too much out of that. Now, everybody remembers Daniel, right? Can anybody shout out a story that they remember about Daniel? Lion's den, furnace. What one skill did Daniel have that God gave him? Anybody remember? Interpreting dreams. Awesome. You guys score perfectly today. Does anybody know what the name Daniel means in Hebrew? It's got a pretty awesome meaning. That's one of the things about Old Testament names. They're just filled with meaning. Excellent, Laird. In one way or another, it means God is my judge. So do any of you ever face people where you try telling them something and they say, "Only God is my judge"? And what they're really saying is, "You're not my judge." And you know what happens when you're not worried about other people judging you? You won't be tempted to compromise with them to try to win their friendship or partnership. The Bible portrays Daniel as having integrity and a refusal to compromise for a very young age. And it gives examples starting at a time when he and his friends were teenagers. Daniel and his 3 friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or if you have VeggieTale videos, if you grew up in the era of VeggieTale, and I see one person shaking their heads, Rakshak and Benny. I remember the Rakshak and Benny easier than I remember Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, but that's just me. But you see, these 3 young Hebrew men, as well as Daniel, were taken captives when the Babylonians conquered Israel, and they were taken away as hostages. This was about 600 years before the birth of Christ, and Babylonia was a place filled with paganism, idolatry, all sorts of immoral practices, kind of like Las Vegas today. They were placed in a special training as court servants to King Nebuchadnezzar. Their names and their diets were changed to reflect everything about Babylonian culture and try to tear them away from all their Jewish traditions. The food and drink was probably the best that money could buy, the best steaks and the best booze, but it likely would have been offered as sacrifices to some of their false gods and idols. And Daniel and his three friends would have known that taking that food and drink would have been compromising what God told them about the foods that they should eat. Daniel was able to convince one of the king's servants to allow them to have a vegetarian diet instead of the best meats and drinks of Babylonian culture. It says in Daniel chapter 1, verse 8, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, 'I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you.' Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see.' So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. You have to wonder why Daniel and his friends had this belief that they could follow God's laws and assume it would work out well. We see a verse in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 30, where it says, "Those who honor me I will honor, but those who despise me will be disdained." I wonder if we live our lives this way. As we face choices, do we always make the choice that will honor God? And do we trust that God will show honor and blessing back to us when we make those kinds of choices? Let's look and see how things turned out for Daniel and his friends, continuing in verse 15. "At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away the choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them and found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom." It was really helpful for me to read the book of Daniel this week. It gave me so much guidance and understanding in the things that I was struggling with. Because there's time when I'm at work, and I think God will understand if I don't act like the perfect little Christian during business hours. I mean, it's just too hard. There's too many people. My boss expects me to be a mean guy and cuss and swear and yell at people. And I figure, well, there's hardly any people that are followers of Christ where I work anyway. But then I look at what Daniel and his buddies did. They were in a hostile place. They were being offered a chance to fit in with the cool people and eat fancy foods and fancy drinks. And to think their only other option was vegetables and water. This would have been a tough one for me. I'm still working on the whole vegetables thing. And I'm 53. You'd think I'd figure this out pretty soon. But Daniel and his buds chose to do what they read from the book of Samuel. They might have even known about the book of Samuel because it occurred 500 to 600 years before their encounter with Nebuchadnezzar. But they wouldn't allow themselves to be intoxicated by the fancy life that came with eating the king's food while they were trying to guard their own hearts against personal compromise. They survived in a culture that was hostile to their faith by drawing a line in the sand and refusing to cross it. May the same be said about us someday. As I read the account from the book of Daniel, I thought, you know, there's good ways and bad ways to draw that line in the sand. Daniel didn't lead a march or a sit-in or a protest rally. He didn't carry around signs that says, do not eat non-kosher food. He didn't even, you know, warn people that they were going to hell if they ate the food that was being offered by the king. Daniel was even sympathetic to the king's official by making a way that he wouldn't get his head chopped off because of Daniel's faith. So Daniel cut a deal. He exercised cooperation without getting to a place of compromise. I thought, you know, Daniel showed a great deal of kindness towards the pagans and idolaters around him. He wasn't pushing his religion on them. He actually wasn't trying outwardly to convert anyone. He was just trying to live his life in a way where he could be an example to others. The principle of this comes out as that if we choose God as the ultimate setter for the rules in our life, we'll make bargains with the world so that we can stay loyal to God. But I think most people stumble into the opposite. In an effort to be in line with the world and make friends with the world, we try to make compromises with God. I remember hearing a few years ago that as Christians, we shouldn't set up our lives so that we're only surrounded by other Christians. One of the reasons that God transformed our lives is that so we could act as light in a dark world. A quote that I loved, and it might have been from one of the former pastors of this church, everyone should have a few pagan friends. I always think that as long as you have a job in the world, you don't need to worry. You will run into a few pagan people that can be your friends. But you know, I think, and I talked about it in Sunday school this morning, there are people who live at Concordia that are in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s that are still coming across pagans and still telling them about Jesus Christ and inviting them to come worship with us on Sunday. So just because you're retired doesn't mean that your time of trying to be salt and light in the world has come to an end. I couldn't help but think of Brother Dennis, who, since he has gotten retired, he's managed to make many new friends, both at the home improvement store and the hospital emergency room. I pray for you every day, Dennis. Now, while most of my study from the book of Daniel is going to be on Daniel himself, I do want to take a quick side journey because it's one of my favorite stories in the book of Daniel. And that is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Apparently, living off of vegetables and water had a good effect on them also, because they were firm in their desire to honor God and not worship any other god than the true God of Israel. In the third chapter of Daniel, we see the following event, where King Nebuchadnezzar has built this huge golden statue. And every time the music is played, everyone is supposed to bow down and worship that golden statue. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to compromise, even when they knew it might cost them their life. And we read about this in Daniel chapter 3. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God said Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. I think the faith shown here by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is especially honorable, and that while they acknowledge, they know their God could save them from this. They even say to Nebuchadnezzar, even if he doesn't save us, we still won't worship your false gods. I hope that each of us will be as firm in our convictions if we were ever to be faced with a compromise of worshiping the true God for the sake of saving our lives. People have been making that decision for thousands of years, and living in America, we're kind of isolated from that kind of violence against believers. But none of us knows what the future holds and whether or not we will have to face that kind of day. So as we continue on in chapter 3 of Daniel, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual, and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, Your Majesty." And he said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." Pretty amazing how that turned out, isn't it? Not only did God save Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but King Nebuchadnezzar actually came to a place of giving praise and honor to the God of Israel. I wish I could say he came to a saving knowledge of God, but there's going to be some things that happen later in the book of Daniel that would make you question that. But at least we can see and think that Nebuchadnezzar is maybe on the right path. Maybe this is his first step in coming towards faith in the one true God. So now let's go back to Daniel. Back in chapter 1 of Daniel, it had said that God gave Daniel and his friends gifts of knowledge and understanding. But it especially points out that God gave Daniel the ability to understand and interpret dreams. One thing you can be sure of is that if God gives you a gift, God will create situations where you can use that gift. God gave Daniel many opportunities to interpret dreams for rulers of the people that held the nation of Israel hostage. And you can read about that in the book of Daniel. And I encourage you to do that. It's not that long. It might take a half hour out of your week. But there's so much there that I think can encourage you in your walk of faith. So Daniel's life was marked by integrity. He never compromised on the message that God gave him to share when he was interpreting dreams. This started when he was a teenager, as we saw in his refusal to eat the foods offered by the king. But in this time of giving an interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar, he also refused to compromise. It was more difficult because in this particular dream, there was actually some bad news for King Nebuchadnezzar. And back in that time, if you were someone who gave bad news to the king, you could expect to have your head chopped off. But because of his faith in God, that God would protect him, and his integrity and refusal to compromise, he told the king exactly what the dream meant. And we read about this in Daniel chapter 4. Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, "Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you." Belteshazzar answered, "My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong, with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals, and having nesting places in its branches for the birds. Your majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends over distant parts of the earth. Your majesty saw a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven and saying, 'Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass by for him.' This is the interpretation, your majesty. And this is the decree of the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue." Not only did Daniel share the truth about the dream, but he shared the truth about how to escape the consequences of sin by renouncing sin and doing what is right. I think this is the second step that Nebuchadnezzar may be taking towards coming to faith in the true God. These lessons keep coming every few years, and you wonder if he's finally going to get it. Daniel's reputation for wisdom and integrity and refusal to compromise followed him into his old age. I hope that can be said about each one of us here. At about the age of 80, which was a pretty long life, he was again called into a king's court, but not Nebuchadnezzar this time, but one of his son, Belshazzar. Belshazzar had come to him to show him the meaning of a handwriting that was on the wall, which unfortunately told the king that he was going to die that night. Talk about bad news. Wouldn't you be tempted to maybe cover that over? Just say it says you're going to get sick tonight, or you're not going to get a good night's sleep. has to be very hard to face someone with the power and control of a king and tell them that on that very night they're going to die. And yet I wonder, as we face people that we know that wholeheartedly reject the gospel of Jesus Christ, do we recognize that when they die, they will go to a Christless eternity? And does it make you wonder why we're not bolder in telling them about Jesus Christ when those opportunities arise? We can read about the handwriting on the wall in the chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. And as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians and enchanters, astrologers and diviners. He did this because Daniel, who the king called Belshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." I'm going to drop down to verse 22. "But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. Here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over his kingdom at the age of 62. You know, you almost have to kind of respect Belshazzar, that even though he was given a message of his death, he followed through on his promise. He gave Daniel the purple robe and the gold chain and made him the third highest ruler in the kingdom. And that was the last thing he did as king. The last account of Daniel's integrity and refusal to compromise shows up in chapter 6. And this is the story that I think most of us are familiar with, the story of the lion's den. After all those nice artworks, I couldn't help but just pick one cartoon image, because I think most of what I learned in the Bible in my early days of being a Christian was from VeggieTales videos. So let's read from Daniel chapter 6. Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first dawn of light, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I done anything wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Here again we see the outcome of someone refusing to compromise on their beliefs in God. Not only was Daniel saved, but the king actually issued an order to all the people in the surrounding area to worship and honor the God of Daniel. Unfortunately, telling people to fear and revere our God usually doesn't work. I doubt that King Darius was successful in converting anyone to worship in the faith in the true God of Israel. So maybe we're better off if we just chose the path that Daniel took. We lead a life of integrity, a life of refusing to compromise on what God wants. And perhaps God will take the life that we lived and use it as a beacon of light for someone else to seek after the same truths that transformed our lives and eventually lead them to a saving knowledge in the one true God. I think that's what Daniel wanted, and I hope it's what we want also. Now, it wouldn't be a Sunday of me preaching if I didn't search YouTube for some video that I thought perfectly tied together all the loose ends of my sermon. But before I play that video, I want to talk about two people today who have refused to compromise. The world will tell you that things such as baptism is just a ceremony or a ritual, and it doesn't really mean anything. But Jesus told his disciples to go out and baptize people. And Jesus himself chose to be baptized and to use his own words to fulfill all righteousness. Today, Brian and Lori Sybil are choosing not to compromise and to do what God has laid on their hearts as a symbol of them wanting to follow Jesus for the rest of their days and be publicly baptized. I hope you can all come out and celebrate with Brian and Lori, because I promise you there will be angels in heaven celebrating at this event as well as us.